Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Mail checks, invoices, documents, and everything you need to keep your business running. Get rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS. And with the mobile app, you can take care of mailing on the go. Make the same no-brainer decisions as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Thousands of Americans have been convicted and sentenced to death for crimes they never committed. Some have even been executed despite their innocence. The Deprived is a true crime book that tells the stories of Americans who have been sent to death row simply because they were at the wrong place at the wrong time. The book looks into the murder cases, investigations, and trials that put them on death row and describes what life is like when you're exonerated after decades in the death house. The Deprived also focuses on those most likely to be wrongfully convicted in America and the reasons why. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Deprived, Innocent on Death Row, with my special guest, journalist and author, Stephen Howell. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Stephen Howell.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for this. Before we get right into these incredible examples of those that were, as you write, the deprived, tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to want to write this book, The Deprived.
My background is that I'm educated as a journalist in Denmark. And all through my career, I have been looking into topics that I personally have found, too cruel to be real. I started out by looking into human trafficking in the Balkans right after the Civil War and how human traffickers, they brought young people in to Europe, forcing them, for instance, into prostitution and so on. And I was by then a very young journalist in my early 20s. And I felt so sad and sorrow for these people that I met that was trafficked into Europe. And from that moment, I knew that if I was going to do any good as a journalist, I wouldn't be writing about problems occurring outside my everyday window. I would need to dig a bit deeper and look into some of these topics that a lot of people, they don't know anything about and that journalists normally don't dig into for many reasons, perhaps because it's too risky concerning their own, personal life, but also because it's difficult getting underneath the surface. And when I later in my career read stories about these innocent people that was put in prisons and worst case on death row, I knew that I had to look into this serious matter as well. also because I had a personal stake in it. When I was 17 years old, I was walking down the street one night in my hometown here in Denmark, and I witnessed a young man that was being brutally attacked and stabbed to death by a group of thugs. And I reacted to this crime. Naturally, I feared for my own life and for many years to come. I was scared to leave my parents' house, and it really did a number on me, so to speak. And I reacted to this fear in an emotional way by trying to avoid it in the way that I demanded that the people who had put this fear within me, that they suffered the same as the victim. So despite the fact that I come from a country that does not have death penalty and has not used death penalty for almost 150 years, to me, my natural reaction was actually being in favor of the death penalty until I came across some of these stories that I have now put into the book, The Deprived.
Let's start with some of these dramatic stories and dramatic examples. You start with a gentleman named Nick Yaris, and born in 1961, convicted in 1982, and exonerated in 2003. Take us back, as you do, to Sunset Boulevard, West Hollywood, and, take it to the Tri-State Mall in Delaware near Pennsylvania, and Linda Mae Craig. Tell us what happens to Linda Mae Craig and how Nick Yaris gets all involved in this.
It was a young lady. She was going back late night from her shift at the mall where she was working. And as she was trying to take off in her car, she was abducted, driven to a nearby site that was vacant, and she was brutally raped and afterwards killed. And a few days later, after her disappearance, two young guys found her. And to begin with, they thought it was a mannequin that they had found, but it turned out to be this young mother of two kids. And the connection to Nick Yaris is that he was actually in prison when he read an article about this brutal kidnapping and murder. And he thought that it was his way out of a possible sentence of the crime that in the first place put him in the jail. So he actually told investigators that he knew who had committed the crime. And from the article that he was reading in the paper, he had a lot of details. So what he did was he sounded very persuasive when he actually voluntarily told investigators what had happened. It turned out that the man that he named as the killer was actually alive. Nick Yaris didn't expect him to be because he had been told that he had OD'd a few weeks earlier. But it turned out that it was not this guy that had OD'd, it was his brother. So and all of a sudden, investigators actually had a guy that they could confront with this crime that Nick Yaris claimed to be aware of. When they confronted the guy, he had a solid alibi. So investigators actually turned it around and they said, well, Mr. Yaris, since you know so much about this crime, even down to the details, well, you got to be the killer. And he was put on the stand and actually sentenced to death.
You talk about his mother at trial, and the most haunting thing of all was his mother's reaction at trial. And then tell us what happens afterwards, his demeanor, what does he resolve to do, what gets done on his behalf?
As Nick told me during my several interviews with him, one of the worst things that actually happened to him was listening to his mom breaking down as he had his sentence read. He would never, for the 22 years he spent on death row, forget the sound of her tears. And that was one of the worst things that he experienced, as he says today. But reality is, when he went to one of the most, infamous prisons in America, Huntington, Pennsylvania, the first thing he experienced was actually being met by a bunch of guards. And they beat him up as severe as they could, because that was their way of welcoming a prisoner to Huntington. But this was only the first of many brutal encounters that Nick had with guards and that he had with other inmates. One of the things that took place in the prison, according to Nick, was a gladiator school, or gladiator ring, as the prison guards called it. Almost daily, they would force inmates to meet each other in the cell, where the fight would result always with one guy, lying unconscious on the floor. And it didn't matter if it was your best friend that they let in. One way or another, someone was going to end up on the floor unconscious, because that was the only way that these guards, they could actually resolve the bets that they made on who was actually going to get out of the ring alive or at least walking. And one of the things that really surprised me when I met Nick Yaris in a restaurant on Sunset Boulevard in Los Angeles was that I had been told a bit about the experiences that he had in prison and how brutal it had been. And when I met him in the restaurant, I expected to see either a man crawling along the wall, because I imagined him to be broken, or the opposite, a cruel monster that had become as evil as he was accused of being wrongfully on trial. But he turned out to be something completely different. A very humble, kind, and intelligent man. Because one of the things that he did while spending all these 22 years in prison was actually educating himself. He read thousands of books, and as he could see he was drifting into becoming this evil man, he decided to change himself. He even changed the way that he spoke. He softened his voice, trying to avoid becoming something that was perhaps not something that he was actually perhaps not able to avoid becoming. But he did. And it surprised me very much when I met him that there was actually sitting this guy opposite me, eating his French toast and being kind and attentive, asking about my life and speaking in an emotional way about his life after being released, despite the fact that all the emotions that he more or less experienced from other ones till his release was evil and cruel.
You talk about his tenacity. You know, the ability for him to keep hopeful despite all kinds of setbacks and the brutal treatment as well that he's receiving in prison. But you talked about that one day he got a revelation and found out about DNA. He had some setbacks with that. Tell us what happened regarding the DNA. Eventually, people were on his side. A clerk found some material after a DNA test had failed before. Tell us what happens with Nick Yaris finally
and how DNA was instrumental in that.
Mm-hmm. As many of these death row inmates, Nick tried again and again and again, having authorities looking into DNA evidence, because it was there. But when he was convicted in 82, no one gave much about DNA. So over the years, it actually turned into be a solid evidence. But despite the fact that it was still there and it actually could set him free, it was not till he asked the governor of Pennsylvania to execute him that they actually looked into it. Here we had this man. For 22 years, he'd been trying to prove his innocence. He had tried again and again and again to have law enforcement looking in to evidence that could prove his innocence. And then in all of a sudden, he gave up. The governor thought, this is too strange to be true.
Yes.
But naturally, if there is a guy on death row who asks to be executed, then I will fulfill his wish. And he accepted doing so, but not until all evidence had been thoroughly investigated one more time, and this time by the use of DNA. And when they came back with the results, there was no doubt. Nick Yaris had never kidnapped, raped, and murdered this woman. And after 22 years on death row, he was set free. And it was time for him to restore life, as possible as it is when you've spent more than two decades on death row.
You talk about compensation as well in this book, and examples of that lack of compensation and the fight for proper compensation amid all the other effects of somebody being locked up unlawfully or wrongfully for so many years. You talk about the toll that it had on his mother, that he could never forget her cry at court. How much of how long did they get to be together after his release?
Unfortunately, not that many years. To be honest, I don't remember the exact number of years, but she passed away. And after his release, he moved in with his parents. He was actually living there with the basement. And he promised his parents that for the rest of his life, he was actually going to make something good of it, because way too much had always been wasted, had already been wasted. And from that moment he was released and moved back with his parents, he decided that he was going to be as kind as days long. And he patched things up with his parents and tried to make up for the time lost. But both his parents were up there in the ages, and therefore they passed away a few years after he was after he had been released. But in Yara's case, as he has also publicly told about, it has been hard for parts of his family actually to accept that the relative they thought was a cold-blooded killer suddenly turned out to be innocent after 22 years. And I have, over the years working on this book, interviewed a lot of people who have been exonerated, not just from death row, and a common thing for many of them is that it is actually difficult for the surrounding society to believe that they're actually innocent. Because in the first place, it is a very difficult and cruel thing turning your heart and head around and believing that the son, the brother, the cousin, your best friend was actually not who you believed them to be in the first place. No, and all of a sudden they were convicted of the most heinous crimes. Then some years later, you're told, well, your brother was actually innocent. That makes a lot of these relatives feel probably guilty that they suspected their loved ones of actually being these killers. But what is more difficult for some of them is actually to admit that they were the ones wrong when they wrongfully convicted their brothers, their sons, their loved ones. And therefore, they continue to perhaps hate or at least turn their back on these exonerees. And that was also what Nick Yar's experienced from parts of his family when he was released. He patched things up with his parents, but some of his closest relatives, they actually did not accept that this man was not whom they had thought he was for 22 years.
Have you heard about the 2018 study that showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? No? Well, now you have. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. I remember staring at my prenatal vitamins and finding all these things I was trying to avoid. High amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and unnecessary ingredients. So, at 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because I believe that all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. I'm so proud of our prenatal vitamin. The ingredients are 100% traceable. It's third-party tested for microbes and heavy metals and recently received the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. You see, we trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. But don't just take my word for it. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Yeah, incredible. You cite the Michigan Innocence Clinic, and they identify six reasons that lead to wrongful convictions. Eyewitness misidentification, biggest single cause. You cite eyewitness testimony contaminated by news reports and time, and forensic methods and experts without proper scientific basis for their findings. And now we'll go to an example that you have, another dramatic example in your book, The Deprived. A false confessions is also a very big reason. And you include the case of Damon Thibodeau. Tell us about Damon Thibodeau and this incredible, innocent guy that got all caught up in this. And it is a dramatic example. Tell us about this.
Damon had a very difficult upbringing. He was sexually abused and violated in many ways by people very close to him from a very, very early age. And it resulted in him dropping out of high school. And instead he drifted. He was living outside of New Orleans, but went to Texas and spent some time there. And I think that he was ruthless in the way that he didn't know as a young man what he was going to do with his life. He was 17 years old when he had his son, but he didn't see his son because he was in a stage of life where responsibility and actually having a normal everyday life was not something that he was taught to have by the upbringing that he had. But in his early 20s, 21 years old, he decided to go back to be close to his family. And for the first time in life, things were actually going in the right directions for him. And he was very happy to be back with his family. Until one afternoon, He'd been spending the afternoon with one of his relatives, actually a couple of them, and his cousin's daughter, they had been roller skating through the afternoon, but because of the summer heat, they decided to go back and have a few cold drinks. This 17-year-old girl, she was not only thirsty, she was hungry as well, and she asked Damon if he could take her to a nearby mall so she could get something to eat. And Damon was tired, so he said, "No, sorry, you have to go on your own." And since he said those words, he has regretted them, because this young girl, she never came back. Some time between when she left her home and got to the mall, she was abducted and taken to a remote area where she was choked to death. And Damon participated in the search for her in the hours to come. And by the end of the night, he went back home and he wanted to rest up before going to participate in the search one more time. And two investigators, they came and knocking on the door. In the first place, they didn't suspect him of being involved in the crime. They just had a few questions to ask him. But as they were there, searching for this missing person, it became a homicide case, because the dispatcher told them that the girl had been found dead. And immediately, they suspected Damon, because he was one of the last ones to see her in the afternoon. They brought her down. They brought him down to the station. And they interrogated him for a total of 36 hours. And within these 36 hours, he only had a few hours of rest. He almost didn't have anything to eat or drink. And when they were done with him, he was so eager to get out of that room that he would confess to anything. He was a 21-year-old man. Remember the background that he had. It had never been a solid, calm background as many other teenagers have. So he was actually not in a very stable place in life. So he didn't have the force and perhaps the coolness that it would take to resist giving this confession after being, as he says, mentally beaten and terrorized for 36 hours. And you know, by the end of the day, he confessed, and the minute that he confessed, he passed out. Shortly after, he woke up in prison, and he knew that this confession that he had given could never be taken back. And the price was spending 15 years on death row, because he simply could not take any more after 36 hours.
You talk about what complicates this story is not just people's ideas that, well, if a person wasn't innocent, they wouldn't confess, but the details in this very detailed confession. Prosecutor took what the police had. What did the prosecutor see, and what the prosecutor should have done with that evidence?
What they saw was something that reality did not see. They suspected in the first place that what Damon was confessing to was also what they were going to build the case on, and so they did. What they didn't build the case on was actually that all the things that Damon said and told as facts of his crime did not match up with reality. So all the forensics that they had back the prosecutor, could have cleared Damon right away, because the confession he gave about how he had violated this young girl had nothing to do with what science proved. But they were so eager, probably, to convict the man of the crime. And if they even had someone been stupid enough to confessing to it, well, then let's go ahead with it. That seems to be how prosecution reacted to the fact of reality that the confession did not match with what investigators found on the crime scene. So he should have had a slap on his wrist for giving a false confession, and then they should have gone and actually searched for the real killer, who has never been found. But instead, they seem so eager to just solve this case that they were putting an innocent man on death row, despite the fact that they knew he could never have committed to the crime. And that is not only something that goes for Damon's case. Again and again and again, people have been put in prison and, worst case, on death row, despite the fact that law enforcement knows that they were actually not locking the true killer up behind bars. And in my book, you'll find more examples of prosecution acting against what they actually know to be true.
You talk about, too, that how these people, and many examples about, of course, these people losing hope, and then some glimmer of hope comes, and others, again, like, reconfigure their life to adjust and to make a better life for themselves. And you talk about Damon's son, Josh, was 4 years old when he was sentenced, and he'd just gotten in touch with the child to try to build a relationship. So what does Damon do in prison regarding his son, and what's the effect for him?
One thing, he didn't only lose his freedom and innocence, he also lost access to this four-year-old son. And Damon actually refused to see his son while in prison because he could not have his son seeing him as a man in shackles, so to speak. He could not see having his son seeing him in a jumpsuit. He could not having his son believing that perhaps my dad was actually the killer that he was falsely accused of being. So Damon decided not to see his son till he was released from prison. That is even after his son sent him a letter saying, "Dad, so far in life, I haven't gotten to know you because it has not been a possibility. But I would actually like to come in and visit you in prison. And I'm not so sure about what they say you have done is also true. So please invite me into your life, even though it's behind bars." And still, Damon refused. And when his son turned 14, Damon sent him a postcard. And he signed the postcard not with his title, Dad, but with his name, Damon, simply because he thought that he didn't deserve the title, Dad. He had never been there for his son when he was having his first day at school, when he was getting into troubles for the first time and so on. he never was there for his son as dads normally wish to be. And he didn't take any stake in the way that he was, his son had turned out to be actually a very good, loving boy, because it had never been under his influence. So his attachment to his son was that naturally he loved him, but he was not going to go and claim to be his loving dad because he had been deprived of being that. After his release, Joss, his son, was actually waiting by the gates. And what they didn't have together for 15 years, they started working on that moment that he was released. And thank God they actually have restored their relationship and all the way through. Just was one of the reasons why Damon kept fighting. He kept fighting to prove his innocence. He kept fighting for the fact that these 36 hours in an interrogation room was not going to be the reason why he eventually would lose life in prison. And he always did that with his son in mind and at heart. And after these 15 years, they also had the possibility of finally getting to know each other in real life.
Yes, incredible. Let's use this as an opportunity just for a second to talk about the sponsor of this program, which is Care Of. Care Of is a monthly vitamin service that delivers completely personalized vitamin and supplement packs right to your door. Build a vitamin routine that's made just for you and your health goals. Care Of's online quiz lets you know exactly what you need. 90% of people fall short of FDA recommended guidelines for at least one vitamin or nutrient. Find out where you're lacking with Care Of's online quiz and get back on track to reaching your health goals. I visited careof.com, to take their quiz. To start, I classified myself as informed rather than curious or skeptical. They asked questions about my vitamin-taking history, questions about my lifestyle and health issues, my health goals, dietary questions, all the questions necessary for Care Of to determine my specific needs. Then they recommended the proper supplementation and dietary additions, backed with the research they used to make their conclusions. Very comprehensive and very instructive quiz. Now, your personalized Care Of subscription box gets sent right to your door every month with personalized daily packs, great for a busy on-the-go lifestyle. And a portion of every sale goes toward the Good Plus Foundation, which provides expectant mothers in need with valuable prenatal vitamins. Take advantage of this month's special New Year offer. For 50% off your first month of personalized Care Of vitamins, go to takecareof.com and enter TrueMurder50. Take advantage of this month's special New Year offer. For 50% off your first month of personalized Care Of vitamins, go to takecareof.com and enter TrueMurder50. Stefan, you include some details along the way with these incredible dramatic examples of wrongful convictions and death row tragedies, people on death row, and all the people affected by these wrongful convictions. Tell us about, you talk about Damon being the 300th prisoner in U.S. exonerated as a result of DNA. Give us a little bit of the statistics on some of those, as you talk about some of the people that have been executed. Just talk about some of those details that you include here, incredible details about the death penalty and its execution in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
First of all, the numbers of Americans that have been executed over the last couple of hundred years is unbelievable. Because the number is actually more or less equal to some wars that have been fought through time. Not the big wars, but a number of 16,000 Americans have been executed by their own people. To me, that's a lot of people. That's a lot of lives. And I think there's one thing that's even more amazing, if I may put it that way. And that is that these 16,000 people have always been executed with a majority of Americans saluting their deaths. And if you look at statistics today, though the number of people in favor of the death penalty has decreased dramatically, if you just go a few decades back, still, roughly 55% of Americans are in favor of killing their own people. To me, that is unbelievable. And especially if you compare the number of executions in America to other countries, then you'll have to compare to countries like Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq, not countries like Germany, England, and so on, not countries in the Western world. We compare to countries that we often see as not being in a human way just as civilized as we may be in the Western world. But that is fact of reality. And you don't have to go that many years back to find huge numbers of Americans being executed. If you roughly go back the last three decades, you'll find almost 1,500 Americans executed since 1973. That is still a lot of people, because how many of these roughly 1,500 Americans have been innocent? Well, we know for a fact that till today, in the same period of time, 164 Americans have been exonerated from death row. So, you know, it's almost like I want to ask, how many of these 1,500 people have then been innocent, but not had the same luck of lawyers, students, organizations, and so on, hearing about the cases? How many of these 1,500 people have died alone, knowing that they die for something that they never did? And I think, you know, that is, those are cruel facts, that these 55% of Americans in favor of the death penalty have to take into consideration. And I started out by telling how I had been in favor of the death penalty as a young man. But today, I simply can't be. I admit it. I'm the kind of guy who thinks that if you did the crime, you should do the time. And going to prison for a heinous crime, that should not be like a vacation in a hotel. No, you should feel the consequences of the evil and the harm that you've done to others. But that doesn't mean that the only way of making brutal killers pay for the price is by putting them on death row. And in my opinion, you always have benefit of the doubt. And in this case, this benefit of the doubt must go to the innocent on death row. And instead, the people that we know with certainty did the crimes on death row, why not put them in prison for life? If it's without parole it takes to save innocent lives, well, then be it. But you cannot get a dead man out of the grave. You can, on the other hand, get an innocent man out of his cell if it turns out that he is one of these thousands and thousands of Americans that has already been exonerated.
Absolutely. I think one of the most dramatic stories in this book is of Sonia Sunny Jacobs, death row for killing two police officers in Florida. Convicted in 1976 and exonerated in 1992. This is an incredible story. Tell us about Sunny Jacobs and the predicament she gets in with her husband and Walter Rhodes.
Sunny was, as she says herself, a flower child, a hippie, that at the time of the of her conviction, she was the mother of two kids. One was around the age of 10, and she also had a baby that was, I believe, 8 or 10 months old when the crime that she was convicted of happened. She went down to Florida. She was living in North Carolina when she had a call from her husband, Jesse. He'd been down in Florida working, but things didn't work out the way that he had planned. So he asked her to come down with the kids and take him back home, giving him a ride. But when she got there, her car broke down. And there was no way that they could afford fixing the car. So they agreed to let in a friend of Jesse's, giving them a ride upstate. And they never should have accepted Walter Rhodes' offer. Because during night they pulled over and they were resting when a police officer did a routine check on them. And he could see that in the bottom of the car, there was lying a gun between the legs of Walter Rhodes. And at the same time, he got a message back from the dispatcher telling that Walter Rhodes was actually on parole and therefore naturally not allowed to have a gun. So the officer asked Walter Rhodes to step out of the car together with Sonny's husband, Jesse. And when they stepped out, things escalated. And the police officer was not the only one drawing his gun. Walter Rhodes did as well. And he ended up killing this police officer. But not only him. He was actually that night being escorted by a Canadian police officer who was there to visit him and see how the highway patrols were actually operating in Florida. But he lost his life as well on that night. And right after hearing the shots, Sonny was naturally paralyzed. when it happened, she was on the back seat, covered up, in a blanket probably, lying next to her two small kids. But with these shots blasting through the night, her life changed dramatically. And Walter Rhodes afterwards forced Sonny, her kids, and her husband Jesse into the police car, and they took off. And as they were escaping, they also abducted another man using his car. And it was not till they came to a roadblock that Walter Rhodes was trying to avoid that the car was stopped, and it was stopped by the police opening fire on the getaway car, despite the fact that police officers knew that in the car there were two small kids and an older man. Because as this older man was abducted and his car was taken, everything was seen and witnessed by his wife. So she was the one calling in that her husband had been kidnapped at gunpoint, and she could describe that he was not alone in the car. He was together with, among others, two kids. But it seemed like the police in Florida were so keen on stopping a cop killer that they didn't mind shooting into a car with kids. Thank God the only one who was actually hit by these flying bullets was Walter Rhodes himself. But being an ex-felon, he knew his way around the system. So what he did was, immediately in hospital, asking for a plea bargain. And he ended up spending 18 years in prison while Sonny and her husband, Jesse, went to death row, because he was the one who cut a deal, claiming that Jesse was the guy who had killed these two cops. The worst thing about this story is that though it was later proven that both Sonny and Jesse were innocent of the crimes, Jesse was not there to experience being set free. 2 years before he was proven innocent, the state of Florida actually managed to execute him. So he was a living proof of an innocent man ending up dead.
You also include the horror. I mean, just to add to even more, again, even more dramatic, is that they have to kill him three times. He's lit on fire virtually, his hair and smoke coming out of his ears.
Yeah.
They have to kill him three times.
Yeah. And that's another fact of all these executions that has taken place through time. Executing a man is not an easy task, or at least it's not easy for the person being executed. So many of these executions has gone wrong, with, in this case, fire coming out of more or less ears and nose of the person being executed. In other cases, the executions has prolonged for so long that inmates have even been offered to visit the toilet before coming back.
Yeah,
being attempted to being executed again. And a lot of these death row inmates that I've interviewed, they were not only fearing death. Perhaps there was one thing they feared more than death, and that was the road that would lead them there. because they knew that there was a terrible possibility of them not going right away. And all these death row inmates, they knew that being killed was painful because again and again and again, they experienced the guy in the next cell being dragged out, strapped down, and executed. And witnesses, often reporters, they would come out of the execution chamber telling about how these death row inmates had suffered, not for 10 minutes, at times for perhaps an hour before being killed. And it was not only reporters and law enforcement official witnessing this. At times, it would even be their mothers. Being executed is by no means an easy thing to go through, as many people would probably think. And some of the people that I've been talking to have also told that these physical executions are not a difficult, life-haunting event for just the prisoners. It also is for the people witnessing it. And at times, also for the people who are actually the ones that have at times volunteered or been chosen to go through with these executions. Because one thing is, when you sit by your desk or you're having coffee with your colleagues and you talk about what's going to happen and you prepare yourself, but when you go home at night and you lie in your bed and you close your eyes, you have to live with the fact that you were actually the guy or one of the guys who put this man to death. And I guess that it's got to raise a lot of questions among also law enforcement officials.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Yes. When we talk about Sonny and we talk about the effect of this wrongful conviction and the people that helped her, but just the tragedy, her parents that were, because she lost her kids to foster care, her parents were taking care of the children. They went on a vacation. They died in a plane crash along with 143 other people.
Yeah.
She was allowed to go to the funeral because she now wasn't on death row. Tell us about what they even did at the funeral regarding the coffins. I couldn't believe this.
When they were put to rest and as they were about to lower the coffins, Sonny, to her surprise, actually realized that they had been put microphones underneath the coffins. So who would do this? She came to one conclusion that either it would be law enforcement actually expecting her to confess by her parents' coffins to the crimes, or what was perhaps more likely, that it could be media's actually also wanting her last words to her parents at their graveside. And this just shows how cynical some people can be at the time in life where we as human beings are most vulnerable, when we're saying goodbye to our parents. But still, that is not enough for some people, and therefore they put microphones underneath the coffins.
Yeah. She managed to build her life, and you talk about some good news in this book about meeting a fellow exonerated man, Peter Pringle, and they fell in love in 2011. They were married in New York in the presence of celebrities like Susan Sarandon, an anti-death penalty activist. And tell us a little bit about this new role for Sonny Jacobs.
After being exonerated, she started giving speeches against the death penalty. And one of these speeches took her to Ireland. And she was giving a speech in a pub. And on the first row, there was sitting a guy. And it's very difficult for people listening to these speeches, actually putting themselves on death row, or actually understanding fully how a death row inmate or an exoneree feels. But there was this guy who did, because he turned out to have been wrongfully convicted and sentenced to death in Ireland for a crime that he did not commit. And after the speech, he walked up to Sonny, and over the months to come, they developed a relationship, they fell in love, and as you said, they got married. And when I interviewed Sonny, she said something that almost took me off my feet. She said that life turned out beautiful, despite what she has been going through and suffered. And it's because she has chosen to view the life that she was given after death row in prison in a positive, beautiful way. And she's doing that together with her husband, Peter. And they try together to help other exonerees getting the same positive attitude towards life. But also have to say, one of the remarkable things about my discoveries while interviewing these death row inmates, that is that many of them have become very spiritual. Many of them has actually become very religious. To some, religion has been what has kept their hopes up. And it's not only Sonny who has chosen to have a positive attitude towards life. We started out by talking about Nick Yaris and all the brutality that he witnessed, and also the brutality that he exposed other prisoners to while incarcerated. He lives by, as many of the others, this everyday form that they have to show the kindness to others that others could not show to them when they put them away for something that they didn't. And one of the things that actually set me off with this book was I wanted to look into if it was only Nick Yaris being so positive towards other people, and if he was the only one who actually were able to
avoid becoming cynical and bitter in his life after death row. But it goes for all the people that I've talked to, that every day they try to make the most of their lives, but not only towards themselves, also towards others. And I think that is amazing. I think that one of the reasons why Sonny and the rest of them are so positive is actually because they have had all chances in life of becoming hateful, but they have also tasted and realized what hate does to a person. If you get out of bed every morning with the life that you have been given after death row, deciding to be angry and hateful, well, then perhaps that life you've been given is not worth living. But if you turn it around and you say, what others could not do for me and the kindness that they could not show me, if I can do that to them, then the life I've been given is a life worth living. And that is one of the things that have surprised me the most working with these people. It is their ability to be loving human beings despite having so much injustice and cruelty committed to them. And you know what it's like, we all do. When you hear stories like this, we say to ourselves, well, tomorrow I'm going to hug and kiss my kids a bit more, and I'm not going to yell at my wife, and I'm going to be a bit more positive when I get to work. Personally, I have to admit, well, normally it doesn't last that long, perhaps an hour or so, and then, you know, why are all these toys lying around? And, you know, I fall back like perhaps most of us does. But these people, they actually manage to carry on with this positive attitude towards other, not just day by day, but year by year. And I really think that they deserve a lot of credit for the way that they have turned their lives around. But having that said, that doesn't mean that life is easy for them, because most of them are actually leading lives where they are affected by the cruelty done to them, a lot of aspects. When you interview a death row exoneree, you'll often find, you know, big, muscular men who you would imagine to be very hardened, but all of them eventually break down and cry when they relive not only what death row did to themselves, but what death row also did to their relatives. There's a story in the book about a man called Derek Jameson, and the chapter is called They Killed My Mom. And the reason why I chose to call the chapter this was because Derek is the most loving, sweet, kind guy that I've ever spoken to, like many of the other ones, or like all the other ones, I should say. But despite the fact that he's, you know, a big, strong man that has seen a lot in life, every time I spoke to him, he broke down and he cried. And he cried like, sorry to say, but you know, like a little baby. And naturally, it was because, and this is not meant in a negative way. On the other hand, I think that it is, you know, beautiful that a man that has seen what he has seen can actually be so in touch with his emotions as he is. But I thought, you know, that every time he cried, it was because he was reliving the experiences that he had on death row and what had been done to him. But I got the feeling that what even made him cry harder and more than his own experiences were the experiences of his mom. Because imagine what it is like for a mom having to live with the fact that her son is innocent but still on death row. And Derek, his execution was scheduled 6 times.
Yeah.
6 times. And the last time execution was scheduled, he had to stay 90 minutes before they were actually going to kill him. Imagine if your mom or dad or brother or sister or just a loving soul, imagine how you would react knowing that 90 minutes from now, your son is going to die, and actually being that told 6 times. When his execution was scheduled, there were always 2 questions that law enforcement or prison official asked him. What he was going to have for his last meal, and to whom they were going to send his body. So again, you know, I have to think about what it does to parents knowing that perhaps a week from now, a month from now, or just 90 minutes from now, you'll receive a coffin with the person that you love the most in the world. So all relatives are collateral damage of the death penalty. And that is another thing that should be taken into consideration when the leader of the free world executes its own people.
Yes, absolutely. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about the deprived innocent on death row. It is truly a remarkable collection of very, very powerful stories and incredible and shocking cases, life on death row. Also, for those that are listening to this interview, there is another incredible story, too, about Marietta Yager, mother of Susie Yager and the founder of Journey to Hope. And for those people that are going to be lucky enough to read this book, just another fascinating, incredible, hard-to-believe story, just another dramatic demonstration of the kinds of stories that you've picked for The Deprived. Stefan, tell us, tell the audience where they might find out more information about how to get this book and about your work.
First of all, the book will be released on February 15th. And it will be available through all major online retailers around the world. They can also, when they look up the book, they can also actually go to my website where they can read parts of the book. And my hope is that this is just one interview of many interviews to follow concerning this book, because I think it is such an important topic putting focus on. We really need to discuss if it's okay in 2019 continuing to kill your own citizens. And therefore, I hope that this book, my wish is that it will change the opinion of some of these people in favor of death penalty. And if it doesn't change the opinion, at least take a minute to think about what you are actually in favor of. And I also hope that this book will lead to having students debating it. I really hope that young people will also read the book, because if our generations are not willing to abolish the death penalty, the generations to come have that possibility. And I hope this book will give them an insight to what has been a common thing for hundreds of years, and therefore perhaps not something that we think too much about, or at least that something does not, because it's there and it always has been. If this book can help them think about if it also should be there in the future, then I'm very grateful, and then I rest my case.
Absolutely. Well, congratulations on The Deprived, and hope to talk to you again real soon. Thank you very much for The Deprived, Innocent on Death Row. Thank you, Stefan Howe. Thank you very much. Good night.
Thank you very much. Good night.
Good night.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.